We're going to be reading from 1 Corinthians 1, verse 18 to the end of the chapter, verse 31. We're going to be reading from the NIV, which is our translation we have in the pew. 1 Corinthians 1, 18 to 31. For the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise. The intelligence of the intelligent I will frustrate. Excuse me. Where is the wise person? Where is the teacher of the law? Where is the philosopher of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world through its wisdom did not know him, God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached to save those who believe. Jews demand signs, Greeks look for wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to the Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. But to those whom God has called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than human wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than human strength. Brothers and sisters, think of what you were when you were called. Not many of you were wise by human standards. Not many were influential. Not many of noble birth. But God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. God chose the lowly things of this world and the despised things and the things that are not to nullify the things that are, so that no one may boast before him. It is because of him that you are in Christ Jesus, who has become for us wisdom from God. That is our righteousness, holiness, and redemption. Therefore, as it is written, let the one who boasts boast in the Lord. Well, at home, I have a children's book about a hippo, about a hippopotamus, that sits on a bridge and blocks this crossing from one side of the river to the other. And there's all these animals that come along, and they're sort of frustrated at this hippopotamus because they can't get to whatever it is that they want on the other side of the river. I don't remember the name of the book offhand, but many of you are probably familiar with it. So anyway, there's a lion, there's a monkey, I believe, and a warthog. And they're sort of strategizing about, okay, how can we get this hippo out of the way? And then there's this mouse as well that comes in the picture a little bit later. Well, the lion, as you might imagine, comes up and says, I am going to just roar as loud as I can. I'm the king of the jungle, and he's going to move because I am the king. I will make him move. That doesn't work. And then the monkey comes along and says, well, maybe we could team up. We can push the hippo across the bridge. Maybe that's what we need to do. That doesn't work either. And then the warthog comes up with his own theory about how they can bounce the hippo off the bridge. And, you know, that sort of kind of works at first. He bounces up, comes crashing down. And then the hippo, obviously, when he comes down, he shoots the other ones off the bridge because he's much bigger than they are. So, anyway, it's a neat story. But then the mouse comes up after the fact, and he goes up and whispers something in this hippopotamus's ear. And you know what? Lo and behold, the hippo gets up and walks off the bridge, to the astonishment of all the other animals. And come to find out that what this mouse had said was the word please. Well, the other night, the thought hit me that maybe this book could be looked at with spiritual lenses. And maybe we could see some sort of spiritual truth in this story. I don't know that that's what the author intended, but that's kind of the other night where my mind went. It's not a perfect analogy, but see if you can follow me here as I try and make this analogy for us. Okay, imagine that the river represents separation that we have with God. That on one side, we are on one side, God is on the other. That we are imperfect and flawed, God is perfect. And there's this gap that can't be crossed. And then imagine that this hippo represents all our sins and our imperfections, the things that keep us from knowing God and from having fellowship with him. Getting over to the other side so that we might know God you know, all these different techniques that these animals use to try and get across the bridge represent different religions and their approach to trying to access God and to have fellowship with Him. There's the lion, the monkey, and the warthog, and each sort of represents one religion of some sort. In a nutshell, I would say that those approaches are religion in general. Well, the mouse represents something different. It would, now, if you would have told, say, the lion beforehand, just imagine with me, that all he had to do was go up to this hippo and ask him, you know, please move across the bridge. What do you think the lion would have said? And actually, in the book, there is this kind of dialogue between a lion and a parrot where they sort of, you know, hypothesize how to get the hippo across, and the lion's like, I'm just going to make him move. I'm going to go up and roar. He probably would have said, it's foolishness. I'm not going to ask this hippo. I'm going to roar at this hippo, and he will move. And that probably would have been what the hippo would have said, or the lion would have said. And if you'd asked the other candidates, they might have said something else. You know, we're going to use this technique or that technique. But if you lined up all of the animals there in front of you and said, which of these is going to get the hippo to move? Which one is going to make this thing work? Most likely, the last one you would have chosen, I know it would have been for me, would have been the mouse. And then if you would have, you know, sort of, maybe I had some insider knowledge about, okay, the mouse is going to be the one to make this thing happen. Somehow I find that knowledge out beforehand. I might imagine how he's going to do that. I would probably picture him chewing on the hippo's tail or something, maybe crawling all over his back and, you know, sort of making him squirm and then, you know, move off the bridge. But I never would have guessed that he would have went up. And, of course, mice don't talk anyway, so... but, you know, bear with me here in the analogy that, you know, I would never would have supposed that the mouse would have went up and just said a word and the hippo would have moved. But do you see kind of where I'm going with this? If you sort of imagine the mouse as the church and the thing that he whispered in the hippo's ear as the gospel, as the message of Christ. Well, Paul, I think this is where Paul is kind of going with our text today. In 1 Corinthians 1, that the message of the cross and of the gospel is foolishness because its approach resembles that of the mouse. It's more like the mouse than the lion or the other animals. It tells the lion to stop, and it tells the other animals, you can't do it, so don't try. A simple word whispered is enough. What this essentially amounts to, if my analogy works, and if I'm right about all of this, is the end of religion. Remember the quote that I read earlier in the service. Religion basically says to do this and to do that, come to church, you know, do your tithes, be good to people, whatever, you know, go on a pilgrimage, whatever. I mean, all the different things that religions tell us to do are basically just different strategies about trying to earn our way or make our way over to the other side of the water, of the chasm. Well, the heart of what Paul is getting at today, as we shall see, I hope, is that the gospel, the good news, that's what gospel means, is good news, literally what the word means, about Jesus Christ is not just another religion. And I don't know that there is a category or something that I could throw it in, but it's not religion. It's something different. And Paul wants to make this point, I think, in a few different ways. He doesn't use the same kind of terminology that I'm going to use, but this is the essence, I think, of, or this is what I feel like the Lord leading me to say this morning, and the essence, I think, where Paul is sort of driving home here. Number one, religion is man-made. The gospel is not. Number two, religion finds its strength in human resources. The gospel does not. Number three, religion results in pride. The gospel does not. Well, let's look at the first point. Verses 18 through 21. I'm not going to reread these. It really would be helpful if you have a Bible to open up. I'm just not going to have time to reread this long passage and keep going over and over and over it. Verses 18 through 21, just a quick summary, is Paul is saying the message of the cross is foolishness to some, to the world, to those who are perishing, to those who are outside of Christ. But to us in Christ, it's the wisdom of God and the power of God. And Paul talks about how God is trying to thwart, literally, the wisdom of the world. How God has chosen a foolish means of saving people. And He's done that intentionally. So the world, this is what Paul's driving home. The world did not know God through its wisdom. All the different approaches through the philosophy, through science, through reason, through experimentation, through searching, inquiry, reading, studying, all the things that we've done to try and figure God out, they've all failed. None of them uncovered the cross before the cross came. It doesn't make sense to the natural man. God chose a foolish means of saving men and of revealing himself to the world. Okay, why would God do such a thing? So what am I getting at? Why would God do that? Well, I can think of at least a couple of reasons that are warranted by our text today that God would do this, that God would choose a really foolish and odd and weird and non-intuitive way of saving people. The first is to expose the limits of man's wisdom. That's the first. We just saw this in that text that I didn't reread it, but in verses 18 to 21, you see it there pretty clearly. And it should be something that we are more aware of now, today, than ever before. This should be screaming at us today. Our world, as it has grown increasingly scientific, increasingly technology-based, and as we have more and more information and facts available to us on our fingertips, we've gotten more confused. There's more gray than ever out there. There's not this sort of, you would imagine, you know, the more information, the more facts, the more research, the more discoveries we'd make, the more sure of ourselves we'd be. But in fact, you find the opposite. And this isn't just my opinion or my experience. This has been corroborated by polls and studies. The famous atheist Christopher Hitchens, he's one of the four horsemen, if y'all have ever heard that terminology before. The four horsemen are these four really prominent atheists in our culture, in Western culture, that are antagonistic towards religion, especially Christianity. Like Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, and Daniel Dennett are kind of the four big guys. And Chris Hitchens, he died recently of throat cancer. But he's written a number of books, and they still have a lot of influence on the public. One of the books is called God is Not Great. And he writes the following. Our belief, speaking of the rational, scientific, atheist community, is not a belief. Our principles are not a faith. We do not rely solely upon science and reason because they are necessary rather than sufficient factors, but because we distrust anything that contradicts science or outrages reason. So he's basically saying, if it doesn't make sense to the mind and to reason or to science, we reject it. That's what he's basically saying. Well, that may be true for some, but it is demonstrably not true on the whole. In fact, the exact opposite has happened. Recent polls have shown that overall belief in God has decreased, belief in Jesus, belief in the resurrection, belief in hell, belief in heaven, belief in the virgin birth, belief in miracles, as all of that, and they all have in the Western world, in the United States and America, as that has decreased, as belief in those religious realities have decreased, polls have also shown an increase in the belief in ghosts, UFOs, and reincarnation. Most interestingly of all is this, that the age bracket, which is the youngest group, ages 18 to 36, they had the highest percentage of atheism, and they had the highest percentage of belief in evolution, in Darwinian evolution, but they also had the highest percentage of belief in witches, UFOs, ghosts, reincarnation, and astrology. So, and I don't mean to chuckle at that, but it's such an obvious fact that as science increases, as our technology-based, or our culture is based more and more on technology, we have more and more information at our fingertips, it does not create a more rational and cogent society. It, in fact, does the opposite. Because we're spiritual beings. We were made for God and for the spirit world because it is there. And if we're not going to believe in God, we will inevitably believe in something. And that is one of the conclusions that these polls and studies actually showed. And that was a quote from them, actually. So, science does not avoid the superstitious realities, as they want to call them, of religion. In fact, again, to reiterate the point, as science grows and grows and our scientific understanding and reliance on science increases, so does belief in superstitious things. So the point is this, and it's kind of where I'm going with all that, to wrap it up. Even with all our knowledge and information that we now have at our fingertips, man is still very confused. And we live in an age, I think most of you have probably experienced this firsthand, where doubt is sort of one of the reigning paradigms. And it's sort of in to doubt. And so if you're a spiritual seeker, then you're cool. But if you have found something, you're not so cool. That's kind of where we are in this culture. It's cool to be seeking, but not cool to actually be finding anything. But don't you think, though, that if science and reason and information and technology, that they should have produced the exact opposite? I mean, isn't that kind of where your mind would go? You would think, okay, we would have more reason, more sense, more facts available to us. But instead, we live in an age of doubt and uncertainty and confusion and division. And I think most of you who have your eyes open would agree with me. It's very, very obvious. So God is exposing the limits of our wisdom, and that our wisdom does not actually uncover reality. It has to be spoken to us and shown to us by God Himself. That's one big reason. The other reason that I think God would choose a very foolish way of saving people is to expose the true nature of our hearts. If the means of salvation is foolish, it only makes sense, right, that you have to become a fool to embrace it. I'm going to embrace something foolish, so I have to be a fool to do that. And you can't hide. God's design is such that it forces our hearts to be laid bare. We can't hide our problems, because the essence of embracing the gospel message is to acknowledge your problems. That's a big, big part of it. And ladies, you know this from experience. If a man is willing to do something really, really ridiculous for you and embarrassing to himself to win your heart, you probably know that he's serious about earning your love and your affection. If he's willing to sort of lay his pride aside for you, then it says something about his commitment to you, does it not? To admit he's wrong, you know, whatever the thing would be, to look bad in some ways. And that's the essence of what God has done here. He's created a way that you can't pretend. You can't be a Christian and pretend. It's very hard. We try in this country, and a lot of us do it successfully. But really, you cannot pretend. And to those of us who really understand what is going on, you see through it. To come to the foot of the cross requires a person to humble themselves, to admit their problems and seek help. It requires a measure of humiliation. Over and over again in the Bible, we see the cost of following Jesus is humiliation. Over and over. Just find, pick a leader in the Bible, and you will see they make a dunce of themselves at some point or another. If you're called into the kingdom, it will cost you your pride eventually. And this is intentional. God designed it this way, but it's foolishness to the world. And this is where I'm going, right? Foolishness. Okay, Pastor, so what does this have to do with religion being man-made and the gospel not being man-made? What does this have to do with that? Because that was the original point I was trying to make. You're stacking the deck, someone might say to me. Of course you don't think that Christianity is man-made. You believe it. You haven't proven to me that it's not man-made. Well, I'm not necessarily trying to prove that it's not man-made. What I'm trying to get at is this. A part of the reason Paul calls this message foolishness is because it's unlike anything else in the world. It doesn't have the marks of being man-made because it's so radically other. Since when has man ever intentionally humiliated himself? Since when did men set out to make themselves look dependent and needy? Since when did man set out to reveal the limits of his own mind? When did we do that? When do we do that? Let me show you how limited I am, how dependent and silly and needy I am. Men don't do that. It's not natural. We want to make ourselves look great. We're self-aggrandizing kinds of people. I want to look better to you. I want to look good to you. So why would men create a system in which the primary emblem for its followers is the most gruesome instrument of torture ever devised, an emblem of shame and humiliation? Even Muslims reject the whole idea, I've mentioned this before, that Jesus died on a cross. They come up with other ways of explaining it because they believe in Jesus, that he was a historical figure and that he, you know, that he did these miracles and he was a prophet and all of that. They believe that, but they reject the story that he died on the cross, even though it's one of the most well-attested historical events in scholarship. There's almost no more well-attested event in ancient scholarship. But they reject it because they cannot believe or embrace the idea that God would put one of his prophets to open shame like that. So why would men devise some religious thing like this? Why would we do that? It really makes no sense. It is foolish. And Paul says that in verse 22 that Jews ask for signs and Greeks search for wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified. I talked about this verse a couple of weeks ago. It's a stumbling block to the Jews, and to Gentiles it's foolishness. It doesn't meet the world's expectations, right? So you've got these groups, and when Paul says Jews and Greeks, or Gentiles and Jews, he's basically saying everyone. That's sort of, it's the world. It's kind of an idiom for the world, for everyone, all peoples. But it doesn't make sense to anyone, right? We're looking for wisdom. We're looking for signs. We're looking for a certain sort of thing, power. We're not looking for weakness and death and humiliation. So as Paul says, the cross is neither of these. It's foolishness. It's weakness, neither of which appeal to men. So that's the sense in which I'm saying it's not, doesn't appear to me at least, to be a man-made system, a belief. This is something else. The second point I want to make quickly is that religion finds its strength in human resources, and the gospel does not. This point already lies implicitly in what we've just said. So I'm just going to breeze through this. If you look at verses 24 and 25, if you have them there. But to those whom God has called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than human wisdom. The weakness of God is stronger than human strength. Okay, well, let's remind ourselves quickly of what exactly the foolishness is that Paul is talking about. If you look at verse 18, the message of the cross is foolishness. And then in verse 21, near the end, Paul says, God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached to save those who believe. Well, actually, in the original, in the Greek, in verse 21, in some translations, I have a little footnote there, and it'll go down to the bottom and tell you the literal rendering of it. That's one reason why I really like the NES, and more literal translations are really, really good about that, of putting footnotes in there, and kind of, you'll have some, and sometimes the NIV, I think, will do that. It'll have some notes down at the bottom about the literal rendering. Sometimes it's hard to bring a phrase over into the English, and so they have to kind of, you know, because there's not a word for it or a construction for it, and so that's why you have these little footnotes sometimes. So, in the Greek, though, the original in verse 21 is not what was preached, but preaching. The foolishness of preaching. God was pleased through that to save people, through the foolishness of preaching. So it seems like the idea Paul is trying to convey, it's not just the content of the message, it's the medium. It's the way the message is communicated. The fact that salvation happens through the act of declaring a message and receiving it in faith is foolishness. The message of the cross is not foolishness because it makes no sense or because it's wrong or irrational, like 2 plus 2 equals 3, but because it goes against the customs and ideas of the world around us. It's different. It doesn't, you know, make jive with our sort of normal everyday life and the way we would do things. It seems too easy. You mean all I have to do is believe this message and I get to have my sins, past, present, and future, all washed away forever? Yep. That's exactly what God means. That's exactly what he's saying. John 6:29 is a verse that I had put on me and Megan's, my groom cake. We had a wedding cake and then a groom cake, and on that gives a much smaller than the cake that Megan got, but but it was nice. That's fine. You know, it's not a big deal. But I put John 6:29 right there on the top of it. And it says, John 6:29 says this. It says, this is the work of God, that you believe in him whom he has sent. Not that you do X, Y, and Z, and you go here and go there, but you just believe. The work is to trust in somebody else's work. So the fact that God saves people through a message is another way that God demonstrates His greatness and His power and His control. And this is really hard for us to grasp today because words are sort of cheap in our culture today. We're more of an image-based visual culture, and words just don't matter quite like they used to. But to the Hebrew, they were significant. Actually, you know, they see power in words. They see creative force in words God created through the spoken word. And they see us as being speech-filled creatures, as being a way that we image forth God's character and who He is and His being. So the power of words to the Hebrew is very, very great. And if you go to James 3, maybe make a note of that sometimes. James chapter 3, James, the brother of Jesus, a Hebrew. Go look at that chapter and you'll get a feel for how significant words are to the Hebrew. But the fact, again, that God chooses to do His saving work through words says something. We need to think about this. This is a crucial thing to sort of ponder for a moment. God is taking the power out of our hands, is He not? The kingdom doesn't move forward by sword or by decree or by building cathedrals or by having lots and lots of children. It moves forward through the proclamation of a message. Once again, the message is foolishness because it strips us of the power to push the kingdom forward. We can't do it. Don't you feel the powerlessness of that? That, okay, God's work is through something I'm saying. You feel, I can't do anything. I can say something. But at the end of the day, it's God's work to do. It's all up to God. But this is another way, again, of God humbling us and reminding us of our place. And that leads us up to our last point here. Religion results in pride. The gospel does not. And let me try and tie all these points together here. I've got a lot of kind of thoughts out there, and I want to sort of try and bring it together for you and drive home this last thought in closing. Okay, what we've said so far is this. First, the uniqueness of the gospel message reveals that it is not man-made religion. It makes little sense why humans would create a system of belief that requires so much humiliation. The only plausible explanation is that those who first wrote it down were actually telling the truth. This is what happened. This is what we saw. This is what He did. This is what He taught. What this means, again, if this is true, is that the gospel is not our message. We didn't invent it. Therefore, we can't boast about it. I can't go around, you know, popping my collar and acting like I'm something great because I've got this message. No, it feels good to have the message. It does. But I can't boast in it. There's no reason for me to be prideful about that. It's not my message. I didn't invent it. Second, the gospel is a message that is communicated through a medium, namely preaching, that strips man of his ability to bring about the desired changes in people's lives or in culture. What this means is that the gospel forces us, again, to rely on God. It forces us to recognize that change comes from God. Therefore, we can't boast or brag in that either. Can't boast and, look at that, I did that. I brought about that change. No, because it happens in a way that there's just no way, if you're in your right mind, that you can boast about it. And lastly, this is the final point to sort of bring the strings together here. We're going to see that God mostly calls people who are insignificant by worldly standards. Therefore, we cannot boast about that either. Can't boast about the fact I'm a great guy. God called me because I was rich or because I was this or I was that. No, God calls all kinds of people, but predominantly they are poor and they are insignificant. If you look across the world, America is the one exception. If you look across the world, but even here in America, I mean, it would be very fair to say that the majority of people who are Christians are on the margins of society now. Maybe that wasn't always the case, but it's definitely so now. If you look across the world, though, this is very, very easy to see. Because most Christians in the world are now in Africa, in Asia, and in South America, all of which are poorer places. Well, let's read verses 26 to 31. Again, I would read the whole thing. I'm not going to. But basically, Paul says this: consider your calling, brothers. Not many of you were wise according to worldly standards. Not many were powerful. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. And then in the middle of this text, he says, he gives us an idea about why he did that. So that no human being might boast in the presence of God. So that's kind of the point that we're sort of, driving home here, is we have no reason to boast. If you look at it, and that's kind of what I've been trying to outline here, there's nothing really we can boast in except the Lord, which is the final verse of this text. Over and over, I have heard people say the church is full of hypocrites. I think they use that as a kind of argument to sort of say that maybe the church's message is either false or that it's just too frustrating to get involved with those people. I don't want to get involved with them because they're all hypocrites. And their hypocrisy is sort of, you know, makes their message suspect. And I can understand that on one level. But given what we've just read, you might expect this, right? I mean, really, right? You might expect this. There's an old saying that says the church is a hospital for sinners, not a museum for saints. Well, if that's true, then isn't the health of those in the hospital comparatively worse than those who are of the health of those that are in museums? It makes sense, right? That the church is a messed up place. It's a hospital. It's a place where broken people come. Tim Keller writes in his book, The Reason for God, it is often the case that people whose lives have been harder and who are lower on the character scale are more likely to recognize their need for God and turn to Christianity. So we should expect then that many Christians' lives would not compare well to those of the non-religious. And if we're preaching the gospel as we should be, I think this church should be filled with people whose lives are broken and wrecked. If there are no people like that around us, maybe it calls into question our understanding of the gospel, of who Jesus was and what he came to do. And as I said in previous sermons, part of the reason that the church is becoming more and more marginal in our culture, I think, not just, it is because of sin, ultimately, that's the bottom line, that's maybe overly simplistic, but there are more complicated ways to sort of nuance that. And one of those, I think, is because the church has turned the gospel into run-of-the-mill religion. We've stopped preaching what made it so radical and earth-shattering in the first place. This was unlike it. Actually, early Christians were called atheists. What? Because their message was so radically different. They didn't know what to call it. They just threw it in some other category. They called them the atheists. And at that time, no one was atheist. This is back in the days of Jesus, shortly thereafter. We've turned the gospel into a religion. We've turned it into another self-help program, into another chicken soup for the soul kind of thing. And we believe the lie that if you tell people about Jesus' love, that if you tell them too much of His grace and His forgiveness, they will abuse it. The lie is that we have to give people some rules to follow so that they don't get carried away with grace. Too much grace is bad for people. You better come to church, or you better stop doing that, or you better start reading that Bible, or that's religion. Jesus despised religion. And that is why he constantly butted heads with the religious authorities in the Bible over and over and over again. Tullian Chivagin, who's related to Billy Graham on Ruth Bell Graham's side, I think he's a grandson somehow in there. All too often, he writes this in one of his books called Jesus Plus Nothing Equals Everything. And I'm going to close on this next thought here. All too often, I've wrongly concluded that the only way to keep licentious people, that is, people who sort of feel freedom to do whatever they want to do, the only way to keep them in line is to give them more rules, to lay down the law. The fact is, however, the only way licentious people start to obey is when they get a taste of God's radical, unconditional acceptance of sinners. Grace alone melts the heart and changes us from the inside out. Progress in obedience, this is key, happens only when our hearts realize that God's love for us does not depend on our progress in obedience. God loves us no matter how well we're doing. That's the point. Where do you think people will run when they're hurting? Or when they've come to the end of the road, are they going to run to the person who's going to give them a lecture about how dumb they were? Told you so. That was stupid. No, they're not going to do that. They are going to go wherever they feel loved and welcomed. And too often, you know where that is? Right back where the problem came from. Right back to where the problem is. You know, wherever that is. For all of us, we all have those circles and those problems and those issues, and we run back to them because they make us feel something. That's where they're going to go if they're not feeling welcomed and loved anywhere else. So do you see what God is doing and kind of what I'm driving home in this message here? Do you see why Paul's last word to us in this passage is, "Let him who boasts, boast in the Lord"? It's because God is giving us no reason to brag or boast about anything. We can't boast about it being our message. We can't boast about our power or our resources. We can't boast about who we are. There's nothing to boast in except the Lord and what He has done. Because if you understand the gospel, there's no reason you should be proud of yourself. There's no reason that you should think yourself better than anyone out there in this community. In fact, I would say, given what we've said, most of us in here, in a lot of ways, are probably worse than a lot of people out in the community. The reason you are here is because of the grace of our good God. And that's the message that we need for ourselves, and that's the message that our community needs. So as we come to the communion table here in a few moments, I want to encourage us to stew on this a little bit, to let that sit with us. What does it mean for God to be gracious? You know, and really to see how God has given us no reason to boast here. There's nothing. This table is not about something we've done. This is about what God has done for us. And all He asks us to do is to step into that and receive it. Amen.